Hi, I'm Jane Williams, host of Bloomberg EDU, our weekly look at all things education here on Bloomberg Radio. You can hear us on the air Friday nights at 10 p.m., Saturdays at 5 a.m., 11 a.m., 8 p.m., and midnight, and Sundays at 7 p.m. Now, here's this week's podcast. I'm happy to welcome to our program the Governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie. And I should point out that while I don't vote in New Jersey, I'm married to a Jersey guy, and we live part of our lives at the Jersey Shore. The governor is joining us on his cell phone, but I trust he's not driving. Thanks for being with us, Governor.
Not driving, Jane. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure. I want to start by giving our listeners a quick thumbnail on where you and your state stand on education. So New Jersey's at the top of the list for education spending in this country. The latest numbers I've seen per student are about $18,000. And the latest numbers put the graduation rate at 83%, which is also top of the national list. It varies a lot from district to district, and that number is just 62% for Black students and 64% for Hispanic students. New Jersey recently passed a plan that reins in the cost of benefits and pensions for public employees, which includes teachers. And the governor has a task force working on some of the major education issues, including funding and teacher evaluation. He's not high on the teachers' union, and they're not high on him either. He's a proponent of charter schools, at least the good ones. The New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that earlier cuts to education penalized low-income students and were unconstitutional, and he's complied with their ruling, though he wasn't happy about it. New Jersey will be taking Secretary Duncan up on his No Child Left Behind waiver offer and has just applied for the early childhood round of federal Race to the Top funding. I think it's for about $60 million they've applied. They didn't make the cut of the first Race to the Top round. The governor's lived in New Jersey his whole life and is a product of the public schools there. And he and his wife, Mary Pat, have four children, ranging from 18 to 8, who attend Catholic schools. Does that all sound about right?
That all sounds exactly right, Jane.
Let's start up at about 10,000 feet, if you don't mind. The framers didn't put a right to education in the Constitution, but do you believe every child in America has the right to a great public education?
Yes, I do. And I think that that's one of the things that's different, both in terms of our level of success in world competition and also in terms of our level of contentment of our society. Because I think people have felt like they have the chance to receive a free and excellent public education, and that can be the beginning of being the great equalizer of all the other factors that weigh into success, where you're from, where your parents are from, your socioeconomic status, all the rest of that can be equalized by a great education. So yes, I absolutely believe every child is entitled to a free, great public education.
And I watched your speech from earlier this year at Harvard, and you were talking about the broken education system we have, and you said, quote, "Your destiny is determined by your zip code," end quote. What is it about a zip code that determines whether a child gets a good education or a lousy one?
Well, I think part of what it is that in a lot of our urban areas, historically, those schools have been underfunded. Now, in New Jersey, in the last 35 years, or so, those districts have gotten multiple times more funding than our other suburban or rural school districts in New Jersey. But still, destiny is zip code because we are unwilling to adjust our teaching methods, our teaching approaches, and our management approaches of our schools to the different socioeconomic issues that are present in our urban school system. And let me be specific. For instance, we find that children in an urban setting need to have a longer school day and a longer school year, in part because they often have both parents, or if it's a single parent home, who are working more than one job. And having them there to be able to do their homework at school, to get additional instruction, is very important. Mm-hmm. The longer school year as well is extraordinarily important because many of these children start from behind because of their socioeconomic status. And we need more time in the school year than the normal school year to get them caught up to grade level and beyond. But yet we have forces that say they don't want to acknowledge these differences district by district and don't want to change it. And that to me is one of the stunning parts of it, and why, at least one reason why, destiny does turn out to be determined by zip code.
And you have an interesting plan where parents can choose a different school outside their own district even. If the districts agree, I think it's going to be about 3,000 students who might be able to benefit from this in the coming year. Are wealthy districts participating?
They are. And in fact, you're finding a whole wide variety of districts that are willing to be receiving districts. And, you know, some of it's economic because the money follows the child. And some of it is that they want to have a greater diversity to their student body because they think that for other reasons that'll be really helpful in terms of giving the students in their district a more well-rounded experience. And so we have a lot of people participating now in this inter-district public school choice program, which we got passed last year and I signed into law. And I think you're seeing in its first year of operation some real successes.
Well, what if you open up all the schools in a state like yours? And let's set the transportation issues aside for a minute. But if you open them all up to every child and you had lotteries to see where students went, wouldn't that fix the worst schools in a flash?
Listen, I think that all that type of option for competition would do that. You know, people would flock to the places where education was being served up in a really, really aggressive, innovative, and successful way. And they would run away from those schools that have become failure factories. In a city like Newark, our largest city, school started about 6 weeks or 7 weeks ago. Of the children who entered the ninth grade 7 weeks ago in the city of Newark, only 23% of them will graduate with a high school diploma in 4 years. I mean, that's outrageous, Jane. I mean, and by the way, in Newark, we spend $24,000 per pupil per year for that measure of failure.
Well, and it seems as if that throwing money at the problem may not be the solution, but having money in the water, and that, you know, essentially having money in the district does make a difference.
There's no question, Jane, that money plays an important role in it. But what we've learned in our experiment in New Jersey, which I think has been one of the most aggressive experiments in terms of state funding equalization for urban districts, has been that it is not the answer. It is part of it. But it's not the answer. You also have to change the way you're dealing with teaching children in these districts. And the reason you can see this happening, we have a number of outstanding charter schools in the city of Newark. The Robert Treat Academy is one of them. They educate their children for half of what is being spent in the regular public school. They are, last year, had the top scores, K to 8, of any elementary school in New Jersey on math and science. The urban kids, Jane, who are achieving at great levels, picked by lottery into that school because they're addressing their children's needs in a way that's specific to that population being successful.
What do you think of Education Secretary Arne Duncan and the job he's doing, Governor?
I give Secretary Duncan high marks. I really do, Jane. He has been someone who has empowered states to be innovative and to take chances and risks in education that have not been endorsed before. And I think it's very much having to do with the fact that this is a Democratic administration. I think it was necessary for it to be a Democratic president and education secretary to do this because they can go to the teachers union, which has been their normal supportive constituency, and say to them, listen, we're your friends. We have a history of being your friends politically, but there's a need for change in this country, and we're going to make it happen. And I give the secretary really, really high marks for what he's done, and I consider him to be somebody who's really one of the leading voices in education reform in the country.
I know you're going to apply for a waiver on No Child Left Behind. What do you think should happen with the existing law?
Well, I think it has to be changed and made more flexible. Let me say this. I think No Child Left Behind was a great experiment in this respect. It finally forced us to take the veil off of our failure. By requiring the testing, we now have the data to objectively prove that in many parts of each state and across our country that our children are not learning and that we are failing in our responsibility to help get them educated. And so I think No Child Left Behind has played a great role in that respect. But we now need to move towards a system that's going to allow for success. And I think this administration, the Obama administration, has been very good about saying, let's increase flexibility. Let's let states make their own judgments on how to best bring success to every school district in their particular state.
And the last round of Race to the Top didn't go very well for New Jersey. Did you have any mixed feelings about applying for the federal money in this round?
No. You know, listen, unfortunately for us, the last time around, literally a clerical error cost us the Race to the Top money by some folks in our Department of Education. And that was very disappointing. But on the other hand, I can guarantee this much, we're proofreading it very much more carefully this time than we did last time, Jane. So no hesitation in applying again, and hopefully this time we'll be successful.
We're talking today with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. What's the Opportunity Scholarships Act?
The Opportunity Scholarship Act is a piece of legislation which I've been supporting, which says that in failing school districts in New Jersey, that corporations can donate, corporations and individuals and foundations can donate to this fund, the Opportunity Scholarship Act fund, and get direct tax credits for doing so. And that money will then be utilized for students to have a private or a parochial school voucher to leave a failing school district and have a chance at a better education, regardless of their parents' income or status.
And you also have a proposal that potentially some private sector folks could come in and help redo some failing schools. Is that right?
Yep.
A pilot,
yes,
for that? Is that happening already?
It is not yet happening. We're hoping, Jane, to get that passed in the next couple of months, the transformation school legislation, where in places where the school district volunteers for the pilot program, that we come in to failing schools, turn those failing schools over to private operators like Kip and others who would come in and transform the schools for us.
So these would be companies that are already involved in education. They could be for-profit,
yes,
or non-profit, but they're educators.
Yes. Already involved in education, with a track record in education, coming in and taking over failed public schools and transforming them through the use of their private sector methods and the greater flexibility that comes along with not having to deal with all of the union work rules that we have to deal with in order to bring greater innovation and success to folks.
And you talked about charter schools. I know there are a lot of applications in your state. How are you going to decide who gets to move ahead and who doesn't?
Well, we're going to be first and foremost looking at excellence. We want to look at places that and folks who have either a plan for excellence and or a track record of excellence if they run other charter schools. Second, we're going to be looking at where is the need greatest. Where is there the greatest need for more school choice for students, regardless of their economic status? And so we'll be looking at a lot of our urban districts and putting a greater emphasis there than in some of our suburban districts where they have a successful school district. And we're also looking to amend our charter law in New Jersey, Jane, to allow for multiple authorizers. So not only can the Department of Education decide, but we can also get Rutgers University and others to come in, review applications, so that we can move to more quickly reviewing and deciding charter school applications. Hopefully that will lead to more successful charter schools. And so I have always said charter schools in and of themselves are not a solution to this education problem, mm-hmm, we have, but they are a building block toward the solution.
We just did a program about bullying, and in the aftermath of a tragic incident in your state, you passed one of the toughest bullying laws in the country, and I know you're in the first year of implementation. How's it going?
It is the toughest anti-bullying law in America, and I will tell you that we have some kinks to work out in it. It places an enormous amount of responsibility on the local schools and school districts, and so we want to see how it works in this first year and whether there's some things we need to do to tweak the law a bit to make it more workable for the school districts. But I know that every school district across New Jersey is trying as hard as they can right now to completely work within that law, which is aggressive. And if I've told them that if there are things that they discover in this first year or two of implementation that we need to change, that I'd be certainly willing to give consideration to those. But no question that New Jersey now leads the way in anti-bullying.
Your children attend Catholic schools, and you've explained why you and your wife made that personal decision. It was interesting to me when you told a questioner earlier this year that that choice was really none of anybody else's business. People were a little taken aback, not because you were blunt, which you can be, but because all of us engaged in this education conversation have made decisions in our own personal lives. People do think they form part of our worldview and are relevant. Have you changed your mind about talking about that?
Not really, no. I mean, listen, I've never made any secret of the fact that our children go to parochial school and that they go there because Mary Pat and I believe that not only do they get an excellent education, but that they also help to reinforce the values that we're trying to teach our children at home. But remember the context of the question. I mean, everybody remembers the answer, but a lot of people forget the question that elicited none of your business answer. And it was that Gail asked me, said to me, how do you have any right to make decisions about public education when your children go to parochial school? Candidly, I think that's just a silly question. I'm the governor of New Jersey. I'm a product of the New Jersey public schools. And it's my responsibility to make those decisions. And I don't care one bit less about public education because my children go to parochial school than I would if they went to public school. And so what I was saying to her was that part of the deliberation is none of your business. But I've never made any secret, Jane, about the fact that our children go to parochial school and what the reason is for us sending them there. For us, it's the values issue, and that, you know, Catholic schools are able to be able to reinforce those religious values which we're trying to teach our children at home in the way they teach our children every day, and that religious education is a part of every day of our children's education. Now, I've said that publicly many times. What was going on here was, though, that somehow that makes me not have skin in the game regarding public education. Right. Well, when I'm a product of the public schools and also I'm paying $38,000 a year in property taxes, about two-thirds of which go to the public schools, which my children don't utilize, and I'm not complaining about that, and I will never, because I think, as we said off the top, it's the obligation of our citizens to provide the funds that are necessary to provide an excellent public education. But don't tell me I don't have skin in the game as governor when I have a responsibility for all the public schools in New Jersey. And as a private citizen, when I'm paying two-thirds of $38,000 a year for public education that my children don't use, I certainly have plenty of skin in the game and care deeply about it.
The issue of teacher compensation and benefits, you've run up against this in terms of your budgets. For years, it seems, the salaries have been relatively low for the amount of work it is and the length of the careers. The benefits have been generous. Do you want to change that equation? Do you want to provide more in terms of compensation and less in terms of benefits? Or do you think the whole thing is blown up too high?
Well, I think that we in New Jersey have gotten to a point where the benefit and package had gotten completely out of control and was leading us to have a $54 billion deficit in our pension system and a $67 billion deficit in our public health insurance system. And so we had to make changes, and we did make those changes. And we're asking for teachers and other public employees to contribute more to the cost of their health benefits and to contribute more to the overall cost of their pension. Still, teachers will only pay a little more than a third of the overall cost of their pension, even under my plan. And so we're not asking people to make some outrageous contribution to their pension system, but we do need to make sure that people pay their fair share and that the taxpayers aren't burdened with an overwhelming amount of that cost. Secondly, I would like to see teachers paid more, and I would like to do it on a merit pay basis, mm-hmm. to have teachers effectively evaluated and then have folks who are really successful receive more in terms of merit pay. That works in every other job in America. I don't understand why it won't work when we are talking about teachers.
Something tells me we'll be hearing a lot more about that issue when your task force comes back in December and as time goes on. Governor Christie, thanks very much for being with us today.
James, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it, this issue. I care deeply about it. We're trying to do some good things in New Jersey. Thanks for giving me the forum to discuss them in full.
This is a big weekend in the world of college admissions, and Janet Lauren of Bloomberg News, who covers that world, is here with us today. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so glad you're here. First of all, this past week was early decision deadline for lots of schools around the country. A few years ago, people were saying, you know, early decision's going away. We're not even going to have to deal with it anymore pretty soon. Doesn't seem that that's true.
Well, this year, Princeton and Harvard reinstituted early programs, and they are not binding. So if you are lucky enough to get an answer in December that you were accepted, you don't have to let them know until May. And they decided to go back to early programs because they felt like they were missing students who were applying early to their competitors and getting in.
And really, to do this, you have to have your act together by the end of your junior year, figure out right at the start of your senior year where you want to apply to college. As you say, often they're not binding now. How many students last year, we don't have the stats this year, but how many students last year applied early?
Well, for example, at Stanford, a little over 5,900 students applied early, and at Yale, almost 5,300 students applied early. And the students know this is a very stressful time, and if they could get an answer early, perhaps some of that stress is alleviated. And in conversations with college counselors in the last couple of weeks, they're saying kids are wanting to apply early somewhere if they can, if they've made that decision to have a less stressful rest of their senior year.
And if it all works out, it's a pretty nice thing. Doesn't always all work out. Let's move on to the subject of College Board. You have written a number of stories about the College Board. Just by way of background for those out there who aren't going through the college process right now, this is a nonprofit organization, and when you sign up for the SATs or the SAT2s or for AP, it all goes under their auspices. You pay fees, they go to them. So tell us what we should know about it. How does it work?
Well, the College Board, their competitor ACT, offers testing to students who are applying to colleges, and most colleges and universities require their tests, some don't. And kids take the SAT or the ACT. They pay a fee to the College Board for the SAT and to ACT to take their test. And there are also preliminary tests that they offer, the PSAT for the College Board, and the ACT has a test called PLAN to help you try to get ready, sit in an actual test, so you're getting an understanding of what that timing is like.
And kids prepare for these tests, as you say, earlier in high school, and then they take them often a number of times. In terms of the College Board, how much does it cost to take the SAT once, let's say?
Today it's $49.
And then to have it sent to a college or university?
It's $10.50 per send. If you know where you want to send it when you take the test, there are four free sends, but most students usually wait to see how they did.
But the average student is going to file a number of applications. I mean, the rare person is the person who knows where they want to apply, applies early, gets in there, done. So that free take of the SAT or having it sent to college doesn't apply to most kids. Most of them have multiple fees.
Yes, and if you want to switch your day, there's a fee for that. If you want to rush your scores, there's a fee for that. If you cancel your test, there's a fee to reschedule it.
And the ETS, Educational Testing Service, ACT, and the SAT, these are all nonprofit companies?
That's correct.
They all take in a ton of money, though.
They do take in revenue. They are nonprofits, so they are not making a profit. They put it back into their business. I did a story over the summer on compensation, and one interesting thing I found was that the ACT and ETS, the Educational Testing Service, compensate their board members on average about $50,000, and that is not the norm for nonprofits. And ACT had some pretty well-known names on their board, such as former Senator Graham from Florida and Richard Riley, the former Secretary of Education.
And the College Board doesn't do that, but I know you mentioned that compensation levels for their chief executive are very high as well. And I think some people would say, well, it's time nonprofits got their act together, started functioning like businesses, started compensating executives well and getting great people. On the other hand, you got a lot of people applying to college. They don't have a choice but to pay these fees, and people aren't feeling real wealthy right now.
That's right. And when I did reporting for another story I did over the summer that looked at fees, I asked a lot of parents to add up their fees, and they took out credit card receipts and they added them up, and they were a little surprised to find that maybe they were spending $800. And granted, if their kids are taking AP tests, they're now $87 a piece. They can add up quickly, because if you're a competitive student and you're taking 5, 6, 7, 8 AP courses in the course of your high school career.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. But then they say if you're lucky enough to go to a college that accepts it as college credit, their argument is it could be a very worthwhile investment.
In the minute or so we have left, tell us what the National Merit Scholar Program is. You take the PSATs as a sophomore or a junior in high school, and then some people qualify for this, but schools are getting out of that business. Tell us about that.
You certainly can take the PSAT as a sophomore. In order for it to count for National Merit, you generally have to be a junior. And the National Merit Scholarship Corporation, another nonprofit based in Evanston, Illinois, down the street from Northwestern, they determine a cutoff score state by state. So the cutoff in Massachusetts or New York may be a lot different from Arkansas, for example. And students are told in the fall of their senior year that they've become a semifinalist based on their PSAT score. And they can become finalists if they do a number of things, including take the SAT, submit grades, a recommendation, write an essay. NYU pulled out. They decided that they didn't want to reward students based on test performance and were interested in helping needier students rather than giving merit aid. And they pulled out. And most competitive colleges, such as those in the Ivy League, Williams, Amherst, Georgetown, Stanford, do not fund the scholarship.
It's interesting pushback against the idea of a test controlling the process, and yet tests are so important. Janet Lauren of Bloomberg News, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And now for this week's honor roll, Monica Bertrand introduces us to an anti-bullying program that reaches children watching their favorite cartoons.
Jane, tune into Cartoon Network or log on to the website, and the message for kids and parents is very clear. Bullying is not cool. More than 100,000 kids have already spoken up on Cartoon Network's Stop the Bullying Speak Up campaign. Alice Kahn is Vice President of Social Responsibility at Cartoon Network, and she says the campaign will go on for the foreseeable future.
We are talking about creating a cultural shift in how our young people and, frankly, how our adults behave. One of the things I found really interesting in working with our partners at Facebook was the advice we got from experts in the field saying it's just as important to talk to adults about this issue as it is to talk to young people. For many adults, it's a rite of passage or it's kids being kids. The fact is we're seeing bullying now both that happens in person and that happens in the use of technology. And we need to give our kids the skills to deal with this, and we need to acknowledge our own behavior as adults and provide good role models, and also acknowledge that our children are asking for our help.
Are you asking the writers of some of the shows for Cartoon Network to incorporate these messages in some of the shows that we see?
We are, and it was very interesting talking to animators and creators at Cartoon Network Studios. Many of them came up to me afterwards and said things like, you know, I was the kid that got my head stuck in the toilet in junior high school. So I get it. You know, this is personal. One of the newest series for us this fall is a great show called The Amazing Adventures of Gumball. And in the first 13 episodes, there are 3 or 4 that deal with this topic of bullying and bullying prevention. I think if kids see in the world around them that this is an issue that grown-ups are concerned about, and this is an issue where they can get help if they ask, that will be the beginnings of change.
Alice, how did you come to champion social responsibility in the media?
I've worked on social outreach projects for public broadcasting, for Sesame Workshop, and now had the opportunity to do so for Cartoon Network and other Time Warner brands. I think that what we realize in the youth media business is that our screens have an enormous impact on young people's lives.
So, Jane, we add Alice Kahn and Cartoon Network to Honor Roll this week. I'm Monica Bertrand.
That's a great way to end this week's program. Thanks for being with us, and I hope you'll come back and join us again next week. We're going to talk about veterans' education issues in honor of Veterans Day weekend, so come back then. In the meantime, you can find podcasts of our interviews both on iTunes and on the Bloomberg website. And I also want to tell you about the Radio Plus app that Bloomberg now has for Apple users. It's just released, and the way you can find it is to text the word radio to 36500, and we'll send you the link. It's free, and you can download Bloomberg Radio right to your Apple instrument. Remember that message and data rates may apply. So we'll look for you again next week. For now, I'm Jane Williams, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
Listen to Bloomberg EDU Saturdays at 11 and 8 p.m. and Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.